Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome to Navel Gazing. I'm John Dickerson. Notebook 75, page 6, September 5th, 2021. Oh my God, we dropped our son at college, and our dog is dead. Anne. Anne is my wife. You'd like her. She said this one Sunday in 2021 while we were reading in the living room. There are at least two kinds of living room declarations, the first of which this is not an example. Punctuates a tense domestic exchange, maybe an argument. I am not a broken toy that needs fixing. Or, if you wouldn't interrupt me with your hostile questions, maybe I'd be able to explain. On stage, this kind of spiky comment causes a pause. Actors hold in the silence. You hear the seats creaking as the audience shifts in discomfort. In the text, this is the passage college students uncap the highlighter for. A second kind of living room declaration does not create a silence, but takes place after one. It is prompted by a surprise pang that arrives out of nowhere, like an arrow shot in the sideboard. On September 5th, 2021, we experienced a declaration of the second kind in our living room on 74th Street, New York, New York, where if you leaned over just right, you could see a sliver of the Hudson River through the yellow leaves of the fall trees in Riverside Park. The play in which a second-order declaration of this kind takes place goes something like this. Scene. The wife reads on the living room couch. The husband reads in his favorite chair. He is the kind of husband who has a favorite chair. Silence for a little bit longer than the audience can stand. Then, an arrow spears the heirloom sideboard. Anne.
Oh my God, we dropped our son at college, and our dog is dead.
A couple of weeks earlier, our sweet dog George had been hit by a driver while we were away on vacation. A week after that, we left our firstborn in a freshman dorm. Cinder blocks, fluorescent light, a squeaky door. Designed by America's best minds to make a natural passage in life feel like an abandonment. On the day of the living room declaration, Anne detected in our space a disturbance in the force. Parenting trains you to suspect silences. In earlier versions of this reading circle, our dog would leap up on the couch and interrupt, or we'd hear the distant thunder of a teenage boy rolling like a tank. Now, neither would peep, rustle, or thud. We could just keep reading without interruption until the conclusion of our time on the planet. The dust would settle on us. As you may have already guessed, it was a Sunday. Sundays are a sniper. You can get hit with a big thought out of nowhere on a Sunday. I once read our will on a Sunday. I do not recommend this. The process required reading 20 pages of scenarios of what will happen if your wife dies first, and then 20 pages of what happens if you do. Becoming facile with the word predeceased is no joy. There are not a lot of Broadway musicals that set this topic to toe-tapping music. Though the Sunday feeling does come up in song, like the Johnny Cash song Sunday Morning Coming Down.
'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing sure to die in that's half as lonesome as the sound.
And it goes on getting no more cheerful from there. The story about that song, if you'll allow a detour, is more sunny, though. Kris Kristofferson wrote it while he was pushing a broom at Columbia Records. For 2 years, he tried to get a demo tape in front of Johnny Cash, but the Rhodes Scholar turned janitor was unsuccessful. So he borrowed a helicopter. He had been a captain in the Air National Guard, and he aimed its rotating blades, which create lift by pushing air downwards so that he might land in his cleanest dirty shirt on Johnny Cash's lawn. The man in black wasn't actually at home at the time, but he was so impressed with the helicopter gambit, he listened to the demo tape, ultimately sang the song, made it a huge hit, and then Willie Nelson did the same thing. He sang it and made it a hit too. Why? Well, everyone knows that Sunday feeling.
On a Sunday morning sidewalk, wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone.
I bet they know how to balance this threadbare Sunday feeling in one of those Scandinavian countries where everything always seems to be going so smoothly. To dispel the existential gloom, they probably send around troops of clowns and banjo players on Sundays like carolers at Christmas. Closest we have in America to teleport us from all of our worldly cares is Sunday football. Now back to Anne. How did I respond to Anne's Sunday declaration? I'd like to think lightly, without a care in the world, like a winning character in a Noel Coward play, or like Nick Charles in The Thin Man, minting some fast remark that had the feeling of ready cocktails and slippers worn after noontime without guilt. Yes, dear, no dog, no child, nothing to impede the race to the bar cart. Or maybe I'd just gotten up without saying a thing and fixed her a Manhattan. I did none of this. Studies show that 86% of marriages stick together like glue when one partner recognizes what the language and happy marriage experts call a conversational bid. A bid is a comment from your partner that betrays a desire to connect. Often, it is a comment that tips gently on cat paws into addressing a larger concern, but doesn't go all the way because the concern is too complex, too large to just blurt it out at the start. It requires a partner's buy-in first, before you can go ahead and say, what does it all amount to anyway, this life of ours? If your partner makes a conversational bid, even a banal comment about the weather, in order to establish the preliminary conditions for connection, and you either A, ignore it, or B, you respond by raising a totally different topic altogether, like how great your new podcast about your notebooks is going to be, then you've written a recipe for doom. What follows will likely be an exchange where you get one of those first-order living room declarations that I described earlier. The moment balls up into a fist and someone blurts out, you never take me dancing. There is nothing worse than needing to be heard and having the customer service window shut. This is why at any given moment, hundreds of Americans are screaming, agent, into their phones trying to tell the automated customer service at the credit card company or airline that they just want to talk to a breathing human with blood in their veins and will not submit to their automated system. By the way, our menu options have changed. We all just want to be heard. T.S. Eliot had things to say about this. To have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it towards some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come back from the dead, come to tell you all, I shall tell you all. If one settling a pillow by her head should say, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all. This is from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, who worked in customer service at Visa. On the other hand, if you respond to a conversational bid with your attention, you've achieved one of the most important human things. You have told another person that they are worth listening to, that they are heard, and that they are worthy of your attention. We want to be loved and heard. And if we can get a dose of each of those from the same person, that's when you've got a hit record. Glory hallelujah. Recognizing the bid is the essential task of the successful living room participant. On this particular day, I understood at least this part of the process. Anne was making a bid. But how to respond? I should be understanding, but not prescriptive. Empathetic. What I definitely did not want to do was go and say something that would suggest I was trying to quickly fix the situation. If you try to fix too quickly, you risk misunderstanding the conversational bid, which is pretty close to ignoring it. An article in the New York Times suggests that the proper response to an emotional bid in your daily commerce is to ask the person making the bid, your partner, child, or friend, if they want to be heard, helped, or hugged. I love this question because it contains many of the attributes I admire in life. First, it requires restraint. You don't just rush into solving the problem, but instead, you ask a question. And as Einstein famously said, in any problem, spend 90% on figuring out the question and 20% on the solution. He had trouble with math. The other reason I like this question is that, like all good questions, it is asked with the person being asked the question in mind. So framing the question forces empathy. And the question requires everyone to be intentional about the interaction, also advisable. However, I did not read the Times piece on the day in question, so I did not employ this winning line. Unfurl it for yourself sometime and let me know how it goes. I'm not sure how I responded to Anne, actually. But I think the fact that I can't remember means I carved no damage. The lack of a specific memory is a sign that I did not prompt one of those incendiary living room exchanges you will be tested on at the end of the semester. There is one thing I did know in that moment. I wanted to write down what Anne had said. On page 4, the field notes notebook I carried in my back pocket at the time, under the line distinguishing it from the previous entry, I transcribed Anne's comment. Why did I do that? Well, it's what I've done for 30 years in life. Yes, but why have I done that for 30 years? Welcome to Navel Gazing, Season 1, Episode 1. I'm John Dickerson. The reason I wrote down this particular entry on September 2021 is I had no hot take I could offer that could satisfactorily contain all that the moment suggested, but it felt like a place in the text that might become relevant later in the narrative, so I took note of it. A big plate was shifting. Anne had picked an emotional truth out of the flux of the day in the living room on that fall afternoon in 2021. But now what? I wrote down what she said so that I might consider the question later. That's what I'm doing now. I'm in the future, considering, looking for the origin of the sentiment, remembering the scene, adding the allusion to drawing room plays, nodding to death, but trying to keep death off stage for now, as we all do with death, especially on a Sunday. All of this arranging attempts to convey what this passage meant at the time, what it means upon reflection, and in the conveying attempt to figure out whether in either time zone it means anything to anyone at all. Behold the lint in my pocket, for it does bring great tidings. The act of writing, of imposing structure, to make these words line up in order, makes the ideas line up in a way that was not available in the moment itself in the living room. I'm doing this with you in mind. Hi. We're only just now meeting, but I suspect that you've had Sunday arrows that have flown through your window in life, perhaps a sheaf of them. In fact, recent LinkedIn data says that nearly 75% of working Americans now say they experience Sunday scaries. Sunday neurosis is the formal psychological term for the phenomenon. The psychologist Max Frankl explained, "The spirit slogs on a Sunday because that's the day we face head-on life's lack of meaning." He was fun at parties. One problem with Sundays may be our larger problem with free time. We may not know what to do with our free time. The working week fills up with its obligations, its demands, and while we grumble about those things, the constraints order our days. But free time introduces choice, and choice paralyzes us. We might make the wrong decision, closing off grand, fruity gambits of delight that would be delivered unto us if we just chose the right route. But what's the right route? Perhaps we should hold a meeting. From 3:30 to 4:45, we're going to have a brainstorming session about how to relax on a Sunday. I'll send a Google invite. Squandering jugs of free time, pouring them out on the Roman road, can make Sundays feel like the end of summer vacation, when you remember all the big plans you had, reclining on your banana seat bicycle doing donuts in the 7-Eleven parking lot on the last day of school. You feel your everlasting summer fading fast. The Robert Lowell poem, Waking Early Sunday Morning, contains one of my favorite descriptions of the feeling of having all the time in the world before you. Squatting like a dragon on time's hoard before the day's begun. If you can imagine the opposite of that feeling Lowell describes, the feeling of opportunity totally squandered, that's the Sunday scaries. Sundays are days of transition from leisure to work. And though we've presumably accumulated enough experience making that weekly transition on a Sunday, we just never get used to the fibrillation brought on by the unpredictability and the difficulty of the tasks ahead in the work week. Sunday is the weekly transition in a lifetime of transitions. Brad Stelberg, the author of Master of Change, How to Excel When Everything is Changing, has made an intentional study of life transitions. He says that each of us experience 37 of what he calls disorder events in the course of adulthood. We're not talking in this case about bobbing through the transition of a Sunday, but getting swamped by the kind of bigger event that Anne happened to be taking note of on this particular Sunday. A marriage, job change, death, kid leaving for college. One of these, we have them every 18 months. Sometimes, as in our case, they happen at the same time. I'm guessing you too have tried to find a way to process your transitions, your disorder events, to put them in some kind of order, to find meaning so you don't feel like you're tubing along on the cream of wheat being pushed around on some giant baby's plate. Or maybe you recognize the conversational bid now that we've put a name to it. You've got someone across the room as you listen to this who, should an arrow present itself, would join you in turning over the furniture to take cover from more incoming, or who would take your hand as you run from the room to flee to diversions of some escape that you both know cures you. These connections between us, which I hope exist, help me manage the key concern as a writer, that this is all just a trip inside my own navel, hence the title of the podcast, which refers to meaningless self-absorption. Universality is found by going deep inside the cave of your own cranium, but you don't want to be a person slowing down the dinner party telling everyone about the dream you had. Let's never invite him back. Michel de Montaigne, who invented the form of the personal essay in the 16th century, also had the same concern I did. There should be some restraint of law against foolish and impertinent scribblers, as well as against vagabonds and idle persons, which if there were, both I and 100 others would be banished from the reach of our people. I do not speak this in jest. Scribbling seems to be a symptom of a disordered and licentious age. De Montaigne locked himself in a tower to write about his views on every topic, from what constituted proper conversation to the endurance of pain, to solitude, to time, to truth, to consciousness, and to death. The form survived. De Montaigne became quite popular, in fact, and lives on inspiring this project today. Instead of the narcissist's delight, I'd like to think I'm speaking asynchronously with you. I talk into this microphone, and you get to unpack it when you need, whenever that is. I don't know if there's just one of you alone in some dark airplane under the cone of an inadequate light listening through the engine noise. Or maybe you're on a park bench, concluding yet again that park benches aren't that comfortable and people should stop pretending that they are, or people should band together and press for benches that are truly comfortable. Maybe you're on your morning run. Good for you. Endorphins can help you get through a Sunday. Thinking about what you will think about what's in my head and how I can best convey that to you helps me arrange the furniture there. You've been with me for the last 30 years that I've been a professional writer, but this is new territory for both of us. Now I am sending a ping out into the world, hoping you'll ping back. This act of echolocation helps me locate not an idea or an argument about public life, which is normally what I write about, but about life. In the documentary Running With Our Eyes Closed, the singer Jason Isbell says of songwriting, there's something we have to say, and in the process of having to say it, we learn who we are. By the way, Jason Isbell also writes about Sunday scaries and Alabama pines. If we pass through on a Sunday, better make a stop in Wayne. It's the only open liquor store north, and I can't stand the pain of being by myself without a little help. Beyond making my vision sharper, you will also see things that I can't, either in what I was taking note of when I first wrote a line in one of these books, or what I take note of now that I look at them so many years later. The community of being human will stitch together a little tighter as you step in. I suppose that makes me a maker of conversational bids. I would like to be simultaneously hugged, heard, and helped. Thank you very much. I've been collecting candidates for future consideration in notebooks since I was 19. I'm 55 now. There are about 80 notebooks squeezed next to each other in a pine box that once contained a bottle of wine befitting special wooden boxing that we were given by our landlord when we moved in. I have a preference for pine boxes you can't wait to open, instead of the kind that you will never be able to open. When I started my first notebook, I didn't have an audience or even the idea that there would be an audience someday. The summer of my junior year in college, I traveled to England to study, and I thought I should keep some kind of record of things. Why did I do that? The reasons have changed, of course. Why did you first pick the thing you wanted to do, and are you still doing it? What's the distance between who you are now and who you were first when you took the first step to become the person you are now? Do you even know when you took that first step? These are the questions we will spear with our harpoon in future episodes. Reading David Grand's The Wager about a shipwrecked vessel in the middle of the 18th century, he described how and why various members of the crew kept a diary, which amounted only to a personal logbook charting seemingly inconsequential events in the day with no particular reflections. He said that the men did it to feel their own voice, to affirm that they had a place, however small, in the world of enormous moving forces over which they had no control. Maybe that was the same for me at that age. Here I am, I was saying to myself, not to the world yet, but to myself. Maybe I'm still saying that. I bought a pocket-sized spiral red notebook at MacArthur Drugstore in Washington, D.C. in June of 1990. I had a round face, John Lennon glasses. I wrote song lyrics on my jeans. I don't do any of these things anymore. But I have carried some kind of collection of pages in my back pocket ever since. In coffee shops, northbound trains, campaign buses, I have added to the pages. They contain overheard conversations. Shy salespeople have skinny kids. My observations. He had the face of a dissipated potato. Quotes from my reading. Democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard. H.L. Mencken. Snapshots from the passing day. Adrian has just fallen into a trash can. Brushing my teeth and prayer are the only other two habits of choice that I perform with the same regularity as carrying these notebooks. If you are what you repeatedly do, then I am a taker of notes. This is the first time I have considered these notebooks or why I write in them. Why am I engaging with the pine box and the notebooks at this precise moment? There is a specific actual answer, which I'll talk about in later episodes, but that answer is too pat. If I told you the details now, I think it would lower the stakes. The proximate why occluding the larger why. If you're trying to explain why you parachuted out of an airplane, the proximate reason is that you opened the door and jumped out. But that's not really the reason. I'm looking for the answer beyond the open door. Maybe what's in the pine box and what we think of what's in them is what makes up a life. And transitions, whether on a Sunday or when you have a life change, make you think about what makes up a life. Or maybe I've done nothing more noble than bound into middle age, standing in the median, concerned that life has whisked by. It's a stock-taking time, and the notebooks are the ledger of my accounts. The body actor F.M. Alexander created a technique for movement to enhance artistic performances, and he said, "People do not decide their futures, they decide their habits, and their habits decide their futures." Well, I've been doing this for 30 years now, so as John Prine said, I am living in the future. The surprises I discover writing for you may affirm the original nudge of a moment that caused me to write some of what's in these notebooks in the first place, whether it was last week or 30 years ago. These episodes are an exercise in figuring out what I was doing in the first place, which was often obscured to me, the pen-holding notebook writer. So this is an exploration of inklings. Live in the moment, some might say. Don't live in the past. Sure, but this is not an enterprise about the past. What better way to live in the moment than to take note of it, to be present enough to capture something about it, and to develop a habit that sends you back into a moment looking for the thing worth noticing, to give the orange another squeeze. There are some moments that cannot be lived fully while they are taking place. To know what kind of moment it is requires some kind of second look. We live a life of constant interruption. Our attention gets diced like a shallot. What if applied attention to small moments helps us recapture some of the richness of the day being taken from us by social media, news alerts, and peekaboo headlines? What if the mundane and the meaningful sit right next to each other? And sometimes meaning can be found by looking for a minute or two longer at what might otherwise appear to be mundane. That theory We'll animate the coming episodes on parenting, loss, the details of the day, the search for order, and the tabulation of experience that amounts to a life. By looking at the past, we are building a noticing machine for the present. Even if what you're listening to ties up no bows for you, resolves no uncertainties, maybe just hearing another person share a similar feeling makes a body feel less alone. That's why I wrote down Anne's declaration in the first place. It was comforting to hear her uncertainty, which matched mine. That we shared the feeling of not knowing what we were feeling was notable enough to pin that moment on the board. And a day or so later, I returned to the same location in the notebook, and under Anne's comment, I wrote, "You count for lunch differently when they go to college. 3 ears of corn rather than 4. Anne wasn't the only one discovering the new oscillations in our apartment. What she said out loud into the living room, I said into the notebook. I too was feeling the change in the comings and goings in our life, a confusion at seeing the draped lines on the ground, once tight, orderly, a testament to the shipshape of our domestic vessel, that they had gone slack. Neither of us had the solution, but Anne's conversational bid let me know we were both feeling it together. So in this navel-gazing, we are considering this together. Learning how to do this accounting together, on the fly. As the Marines say, you do it and then you learn how to do it. Letting each other know that we're not alone, even in the little shadow moments of the day. The tiny living room moments. Or a moment like when you have your last meal with your child before leaving him at college, which is the subject of our next episode. Thank you for joining me for this one. I'll look forward to going back into the notebooks with you in the next episode. Navel Gazing is produced by Shayna Roth. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. And our theme music is from the band Plastic Mary. Remember, send us a note at navelgazingpodcast@gmail.com and let us know your thoughts if you are a wild noticer out in the world, a mopey parent, or a note taker or the kin of a note taker. I'd love to hear from you. I'm John Dickerson. Talk to you next week.